From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan taxpayers paying for the Attorney General's increasingly costly probe into Flint water and lawyers hired by the governor.
This could get very complicated if there's a demand for information that the governor's attorneys consider privileged.
We'll talk to the founder of Michigan's first ever cannabis church.
We want to show people that cannabis users are altruistic, that we are a boon to the community, not a drain on it.
A documentary film about Cream Magazine.
This underdog story of this, you know, group of self-described misfits who came together in Detroit.
And a county prosecutor says enough to a video vigilante.
It's unsafe for him, unsafe for the public, unsafe for just about anybody that could be involved in that.
Those stories and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up on today's program, using logic and reason, Michigan's first cannabis church tries to fight stereotypes. And a West Michigan YouTube vigilante is running into some legal problems. But first, Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette says lawyers hired by Governor Rick Snyder won't turn over certain documents demanded by his Flint water investigative team. With us now via Skype is Wayne State University law professor Peter Hanning. Well, Peter, as of now, Michigan taxpayers are footing the bill for both the AG's special investigation as well as Governor Snyder's attorneys, who, at least from the AG's special investigator Todd Flood's point of view, are not cooperating fully with the investigation. Why is the state paying for the governor's attorneys here?
Well, it's not clear what the basis is for that. In the typical case, when an individual is being investigated, they have to go out and pay for their own attorney. In the corporate sphere, you could have the company paying for the attorneys for individuals. When you're talking about a government official, normally that official would have to go pay for his own attorney. But in this instance, the state is paying for Governor Snyder's attorneys, and it's not entirely clear whether they're representing him in his personal capacity, just as an ordinary individual, or if it's Rick Snyder as governor of the state of Michigan.
Are there other cases you can think of that are comparable to this situation?
Well, you did have the investigation back in the 1990s of President Clinton, where there was a grand jury investigation and he paid for his own attorney. He also had counselors in the White House, but he established an attorney-client relationship with a private attorney who defended him in the case. So there are instances in which public officials will go out and get their own attorney.
What happens if Governor Snyder invokes attorney-client privilege and refuses to hand over documents the AG's office wants? What legal questions does this raise?
Well, one question is going to be the status of those attorneys. If they are representing the governor in his personal capacity, then, of course, they would have an attorney-client relationship. It gets much more complicated if they are representing him in his official capacity. So it's not Rick Snyder, the individual, but Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan. If they are representing him as the governor, then there are issues that have been raised in other cases about whether, in fact, an attorney-client privilege claim can be made when the real client is the state, the governor's office, and not the individual. So this could get very complicated if there's a demand for information that the governor's attorneys consider privileged.
How does what's happening with the state investigation contrast with how the feds and U.S. Prosecutor Barbara McQuaid might be handling this?
The Attorney General, Schuette, has, in a sense, gone to the press and gone to his bully pulpit to try to get documents from Governor Snyder. And so appealing to the media is a way to put pressure on the governor's office to ensure their cooperation. That is not done by the federal authorities. They will work behind the scenes. They certainly don't want publicity during the investigative stage as they try to gather evidence. So the contrast is you will not see, for the most part, a federal prosecutor coming to the press and saying, we're not getting cooperation. They have other means to get the information that they need. I suspect the attorney general is trying to put pressure on the governor without getting into any kind of legal fight with him.
So basically, in a sense, shaming the governor into coughing up more documents.
Yes, absolutely. That, you know, as the governor has asked questions about this and issues are raised in the press and the media, that puts even more pressure because the governor has promised cooperation. And the last thing that Governor Snyder wants to appear is uncooperative. That, of course, draws public attention and raises questions as to, does he really want the attorney general to get to the bottom of this?
Now, next month, the State Administrative Board, Peter, will be considering Attorney General Schuette's request to nearly triple the contract for Flood's law firm, bringing that total cost of the Attorney General's probe to $4.9 million. At the same time, yesterday, the governor's office has said the $1.2 million in contracts that it has with the two private law firms isn't enough. Just wondering if you have a thought, how much could this conflict between the Attorney General and the governor wind up costing Michigan's taxpayers?
Well, I guess the key to figuring out the cost is going to be, are there going to be any court battles? If this goes to court, that ratchets up the costs because you end up having, usually in these types of cases, if there's a fight over getting documents produced, you will have dragged out litigation. And so that would increase the costs rather quickly. You would hope that this round of funding would be enough, but of course, we've seen the numbers go up and up. And in a white collar investigation, spending $10 million on either side is certainly not unknown. And if it's a dragged out investigation, that number could shoot past $10 million quickly.
Peter Henning, Wayne State University School of Law. Peter joined us via Skype. Peter, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
The First Amendment guarantees us the freedom to practice whatever religion we choose. For my next guest, that religion centers around cannabis. Jeremy Hall is founder of a new church in Lansing called the First Cannabis Church of Logic and Reason. This congregation held its first meeting this past Sunday. Jeremy is with us now. Jeremy Hall, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You are a marijuana caregiver and an ordained minister.
I am.
So how did you realize you wanted to really mix the two and found a new church?
Well, it kind of started because me and my wife like to do community outreach, and the cannabis community has been so supportive. My wife was diagnosed with lupus in 2010, and we just feel that there is so much that this has to offer on not just a financial level or a physical level, but a spiritual level as well. And so we decided, hey, it's been so nice to us. What can we do to kind of give back and help other people who may be using cannabis and are feeling a little ostracized from their normal spirituality?
You recently held your first service. What happened? I'm curious, what happened during the service? Were there readings, testifying? Sure. Was there singing? What did you do?
Well, we are an agnostic organization. We're non-denominational, so we don't have any religious texts that we read from. Basically, the way that it happened is for about a half an hour, maybe 45 minutes, we allowed individuals to kind of come in, mingle, get the social aspect of meeting other people who they may not believe the same thing that you believe in, but they believe in the use of cannabis. So after getting to meet some new people, we kind of settled down. I spoke for about 30 to 45 minutes, just kind of introducing the church, talking about our ideals, the things that we want to accomplish, how we plan on accomplishing those goals. Fielded some questions from some of the people in attendance. They had some really excellent ideas on how to make the service better. And as we're new, we're always trying to, do what we can to meet the needs of the community. And then afterwards, we held a potluck. So there was some nice food, medicated and non-medicated, for the guests to enjoy.
What kinds of ideas and questions did people bring?
Well, some of the questions were about making the service a little bit more spiritual. The first service, we did not start out with any kind of prayer, and some of the guests had said, hey, maybe we can work on developing a non-denominational start to the service where we can maybe just hold a moment of silence so that people can, if they choose to, try to either pray or whatever they feel they'd like to before the service. So we liked that idea. We talked about possibly holding a cannabis donation for a member in need, somebody who may be needing cannabis for medical reasons but can't afford it. So maybe allowing some of the guests to help with that, just anything that we can do out in the community.
Tell me about the choice of the name, the First Cannabis Church of Logic and Reason. What was behind that choice?
The reason that we decided on Logic and Reason is because we want to do things that are acceptable to everyone that don't revolve around religious theology, things that we can make a difference, and we can use maybe scientific principles. We can talk about doing things out in the community that just make sense, that are reasonable, that are logical. We focus on using the scientific principle of chaos theory, butterfly effect, where you can make a small change, where you can do something that you think is tiny and insignificant, but down the line they reverberate out and have such huge positive impacts. So those are the kind of things that we want to focus on, not teaching religious theology, but teaching people how to be better, how to think differently, how to perceive the world in such a way it enriches their lives.
I'm interested, why call it a church versus, let's just say, a support group?
There were obviously some legal reasons. If we are working right now to be a recognized 501c with the federal government as well as Michigan State, so they're not really doing anything for marijuana clubs. There's not any legal precedent that it's a very hot topic right now. And since we do want to invite all walks of life for people, and we view it as a spiritual experience, we decided, hey, why not call this a church? Why not? You know, there's not a legal definition for churches. There's not a one specific type of way that people decide they want to be spiritual. So we invite everybody from all walks of life, all spiritual beliefs, to come on out and sort of a church of misfits, of people who don't subscribe to one specific religious theology but want to be spiritual, and they use cannabis to do so.
What do you, Jeremy, most want the community at large to understand about the cannabis community?
Well, the biggest thing is we want to dispel the stigma that cannabis is this hard drug that ruins people's lives, that turns people into criminals, that people who use it are just bad people, and it's just not the case. People from all walks of life use cannabis, and as it becomes more socially acceptable, more and more people come out of the woodwork. We want to show people that cannabis users are altruistic, that we go out and we do good deeds, that we are a boon to the community, not a drain on it. And that's the overall goal of the church, is to change that stigma, to go out and do things in the name of cannabis and become something that is seen as a good thing in the community, not a bad.
Jeremy Hall, founder of First Cannabis Church of Logic and Reason, meeting in South Lansing. Jeremy, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Grand Valley State New Music Ensemble is celebrating the 100th birthday of the National Park System. The group is about to embark on its National Parks Centennial Tour, and it is sure heading to some pretty spectacular settings. Here with us now is Bill Ryan, professor of composition and the director of the New Music Ensemble at Grand Valley State University. Welcome back, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you with us. And with Bill is Karsten Wimbush, who's a GVSU senior and a saxophone music education major. Karsten, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Well, if you were planning, either of you, to write a How I Spent My Summer Vacation report, you're going to have a beauty. Bill, what's the mission statement, if you will, of this tour that you're starting at the end of the week?
Well, we're basically coming together to celebrate the centennial, the 100th anniversary of these incredible parks across the country. And we've been putting this together for a little bit over a year, where we commissioned composers to write pieces in response to four parks that we're going to be visiting. And we've been rehearsing all early summer, end of last semester, and we're headed to the park. So we'll perform the premieres in the lands that inspired the pieces.
And tell us where you will be performing, because we're all going to be very jealous as you run through this list.
Sure. Well, we are driving three minivans loaded with gear, and we are headed towards Badlands National Park, Wind Cave National Park, Yellowstone National Park, and Grand Teton National Park. And we're doing a quick stop up into Montana to perform at a public library during this.
Well, it's a good thing you have young, vigorous people who don't mind being stuffed into vans and caravanning. I can hear you laughing, Karsten. I've got to imagine, Karsten, the idea of performing at Yellowstone or in the Grand Tetons. It's some of the most glorious vistas in the world. How do you think that might influence your performance?
Well, positively, to say the least, to actually be able to see what inspired the very music that we're performing gives us some more depth to what we're doing, and I think will be something that none of us will ever be able to forget. I think it'll be a great memory.
Bill, what a good chance for you to expose audiences from all over the country to what you're doing in new music at Grand Valley, and also these eight composers. So this is new material, and you're saying there's a unifying theme in a sense of celebrating the centennial of the National Park System. But tell us more about these compositions.
Yeah, I really gave the composers, the composers are from all across the country, very diverse American composers, even wide-ranging in age. There's four women and four men. And all I asked was them to respond to a park. And so, they had a list of where we were attending. And so two composers chose, are working with each park. That was it. I gave them the instrumentation of the ensemble. And then it was up to them. And some had been to the parks before that they were writing for, and some had not, and so did a lot of research online. I had one composer, Paula Mathewson, who is working with Windcave National Park, and she went out there in February with a assistant, and she recorded sounds that come from the caves. So she got a kind of underground tour, and that is incorporated into our piece. So the ensemble is going to be performing along with these amazing, beautiful sounds that come right from the land.
Bill, I remember talking to you just before you embarked on the tour of Southwest Parks. That was in 2014. Overall, how did Grand Valley State University get into doing these spectacular concerts in these spectacular settings with the national parks?
Well, I love the outdoors. It's as simple as that. And was really looking for a project where I could combine my passion for the outdoors and music as well. So this is sort of what I came up with.
Karsten, what are you most looking forward to out of this upcoming week or so?
Well, it's kind of hard to pinpoint that down to one single factor, but I think overall the real-world experience of being able to tour as a musician and getting a taste of this is what it's like to be a professional musician.
Bill, what do you hope your students take away from doing this?
I hope that they're going to have an appreciation for these incredible parts of the country that we get to go to. And I know that only one or two of them have actually ever been this far west in the United States. So perhaps this will ignite a seed in them where they go back and just explore or hike or something like that. But then musically, again, I hope that they have an appreciation maybe for the professionals that are touring all the time and see what's involved in keeping yourself healthy and keeping your instrument in top shape and things like that.
Bill Ryan is a professor of composition. He's the director of the New Music Ensemble at Grand Valley State University. And Karsten Wimbush is a GVSU senior and saxophone music education major about to undertake their National Parks Centennial Tour and celebrate the 100th birthday of the National Park System. Have a great time, and we will all be looking forward to seeing videos and hearing those sounds that you're going to be making in those gorgeous settings.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having us.
There is no question about it. Doing science costs money. Here's the challenge for scientists. You have to keep the research going, and to do that, you need money. But just what are the implications when you accept money, whether from companies, foundations, the government? Kevin Banke explores these questions in the blog Thought and Awe. Kevin is a PhD candidate in environmental health sciences at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, and he's the recipient of a fellowship created by Dow Chemical. Kevin, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your article in Thought and Awe is titled Selling Out Science, as you explore the many challenges of doing research funded by corporations, by the government. How would you define selling out?
So say I took money from a company and they got to design a study for me and I just did it, and then they got to decide whether or not to publish that study. Because I would be taken out of the picture, I wouldn't be able to choose the questions to ask or how to ask them. I think that'd be a pretty clear-cut case of selling out.
That would almost be as if the scientist was a tool.
Exactly.
A hammer with legs. Here,
exactly.
You do this the way we say, and we may or may not use that.
And by the way, you can have this money for doing so.
What was your motivation for writing this article for Thought and Awe?
Well, so what happened is I was a recipient of this fellowship. From Dow Chemical. One day I opened up my emails and I saw this provocative email from a faculty member at the University of Michigan that was kind of a challenge to me and all the other fellows saying, like, what do you think about all these other things that DAO are doing, or that DAO is doing, excuse me. And so I took the bait and I started thinking, what are implications of taking this money? Do you have some issues with this, including this faculty member? And so I wanted to kind of flesh out my own ideas about what I thought about it, how I would approach this situation in the future, and what are the kind of implications that that would have for how the science that I do is actually accepted.
And let's talk a little so we can understand. What kind of work do you do?
I study water quality, which is, in my mind, one of the most important issues facing us today. Obviously, close to home, we know about Flint. But globally, this is an issue that affects billions of people. And as somebody who was born in Michigan, in Ann Arbor, it's tough to imagine turning on a faucet and not thinking, oh, this is safe, I can drink this.
That, I think, Flint has done.
Exactly.
Put that image in all of our minds, that what is it like to not trust what's coming out of your tap?
Exactly. And so that seems like a relatively new thing for a lot of people in the States. But my work has more of a global focus. It's in Lima, the capital of Peru, and we're studying a specific pathogen that causes peptic ulcer and stomach cancer, and seeing how it can be transmitted in water and what the likelihood of infection is for somebody who, say, drinks a glass of contaminated water.
And I guess give us an idea of what the role the DAO Fellowship plays in funding your work.
So the DAO Fellowship actually came at a very wonderful time for me. I had been applying for funding, and it was one of a few fellowships that I had applied for because it really fit the needs of what I wanted to do. So basically, it allows me to pursue extra scientific questions, to do more experiments, to travel, to get equipment that I might need, all of these things that will allow me to delve deeper into this question and do a better and more complete job of answering it.
So now we have a sense of how that's working in your life as a scientist. So as you point out, the obvious challenges without corporate or government-sponsored research, we know at times foundations will underwrite research, there wouldn't be enough funding to do the work. Is there a way to regulate research in a better way, or is it really up to researchers to hold themselves accountable?
So this is kind of out of my wheelhouse. I'm a scientist, mm-hmm. not a policy guy. From my personal experience, I'd say a good first step would be to have every scientist or researcher think about these things. And when they're accepting money, be it from a foundation, from government, from a company, to just be thoughtful about what it means to accept this money, how their science might be accepted by the public because of that funding source, and then to be open and critical about whether or not their questions are influenced or their methods are influenced by that funding source. And it might be, like in my case, I don't feel like any of my questions or methods are affected at all by receiving this fellowship. But I feel that, especially because I've now thought through it so deeply.
Now, as far as DAO being involved in or having any say-so in what you do, isn't that part of university policy?
So, again, I'm not a policy person. I think that question could be directed to the Office of Research at Michigan. But from my personal experience, I have had no one from DAO come and talk to me and say, oh, do something this way. They don't have any kind of academic input in terms of classes that we as fellows take or anything like that. It's all directed by the University of Michigan. And honestly, I see it as a good opportunity to meet minds from all these different schools throughout the university to figure out, well, how can we address this complex issue of sustainability from all these different viewpoints?
It's clearly to the point of the email that initially came from the faculty member. There is this question of having one's name associated with a company like DAO with a history with past research. There was inconsistent information provided to the EPA and the U.S. Trademark and Patent Office about the potential harm caused by one of the company's pesticides. Past history. But that's something that I can tell from reading your piece in Thought and Awe. You're looking at this and saying, well, yeah, I am shaking hands with this company.
Yeah. Well, and I think that was one of the more challenging things to work through for me individually, because you're absolutely right. They have done some things in the past that I just don't agree with. But it's a question of weighing the good that this fellowship will do against the potential, I wouldn't even say harm, but just the cost of that association And because there don't seem to be any strings attached to this money to what I am doing scientifically, I think the benefit goes more on protecting public health because that's what the money that they gave is funding.
And we have to say, as you point out in your blog post, it's the same if you're accepting money from the government.
So I think they're similar issues. They're similar issues, but the nuance might be slightly different. So in the case of Dow, accepting money from them means that they have this partnership with the University of Michigan. That definitely benefits them because they're connecting with a top-tier, highly thought-of university. And they also get this pipeline of scientists who has been trained with Dow money who may be a good fit for working at Dow in the future. So those things are good for them.
Mm-hmm.
With government money, it gets a little bit more complex, and I'd say more of a indirect kind of pressure because you have to publish a lot to get funding or to get your funding renewed because the government wants to see I'm making a good bet when I'm giving this scientist funding to pursue this issue.
Taxpayer dollars.
Exactly, yeah. And they need to be accountable for that. But at the same time, like if I've spent 20 years of my life becoming a faculty member, going through bachelor's, master's, PhD, postdoc, all of that, that means that there's a lot of pressure and a lot of sunken time put into that. And if my study doesn't do well, there's some things that people will do to try to find significance in their data, even if it's not necessarily biologically relevant, but it's significant, so it's thus publishable.
Hello, Uncle Sam. Look what we've done.
Exactly.
So that it is really – it is an interesting post that you wrote, Kevin. It's Selling Out Science? It's at Thought and Awe, A-W-E, so thoughtandawe.net. Really good piece. Kevin Banky, PhD candidate in environmental health sciences at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Thanks so much for being with us, Kevin.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And now we begin our newest series, Michigan Bookmark, where notable Michigan writers review the works of other Michigan writers. Author Desiree Cooper kicks off our series by reviewing the new book Swarm Theory by Michigan-born author Christine Rice. It would be expected that tales of cheating, addiction, violence, deception, and retaliation would take place in a Gotham like Detroit. But Rice understands that nowhere is karma more swift and secrets more vulnerable than in the tight hive of a small town.
Swarm Theory is a book of linked short stories that take place in the fictional rural town of New Canaan, somewhere between Flint and Detroit. If the biblical name of the town isn't a sign of the retribution to come, the foreboding, eerie green stillness of the Midwestern sky certainly is. The opening salvo, Atmospheric Disturbances, follows Astrid Mirakal, a teenager whose Lebanese mother and philandering father fill the household with the electric tension of a looming tornado. As Astrid's parents are caught in a destructive cyclone of infidelity, Astrid falls into a lifetime of chasing storms. The stories follow Astrid and her friends, a band of luckless misfits who grow up laboring beneath their parents' poor decisions. As the characters develop, so do the links between their lives. One begins to understand how actions beget reactions and how one life can turn upon the choices of others. In the vein of Flannery O'Connor, Rice exposes the darkest aspects of human nature as the children of New Canaan raise themselves and learn hard lessons. More than once, I wanted to holler, "Where are their mothers?" The answer is that they're largely absent. Mothers pack their bags and disappear. They follow their drug habits. They discover new love. They commit suicide. They become ghosts who haunt their children into adulthood. As Astrid herself realizes, this is reality, hovering in space, unanchored, with no one and nothing to pull us back down. But all is not lost for the resilient inhabitants of New Canaan, whose lives intertwine in unexpected ways. It's a place where faith shines only through the defrocked, where a girl finds courage behind the wheel of a Monte Carlo, where a war veteran's soulmate is an abused dog, and where a disinherited love child has the power to exact justice. What becomes of the hive when the queen no longer reigns? Individuals follow their own instincts, and the collective thrives or suffers accordingly. In swarm theory, New Canaan's children reap the sins of their fathers and the neglect of their mothers. It's a gripping work of Midwest Gothic that is a cautionary tale about the choices people made and the staggering blows unleashed in their wake.
Desiree Cooper is a former attorney, Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist, and Detroit community activist. Her latest book is called Know the Mother. Her review of the book Swarm Theory by Christine Rice can be found on our website at michiganradio.org. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A long-awaited study ordered by the state legislature has come up with the price tag for educating the average Michigan public school student. The comprehensive analysis done by a Denver firm finds that state school funding is unequal and seems to be getting more unequal. Michigan Radio Sarah Swick is here with us now. Sarah, you plowed through this report. What was the goal of the study?
So the goal of the report, the basic goal was to do a sort of what's, I guess, known as a costing out study, which is to basically figure out very simply, how much does it cost to educate a public school student in Michigan up to our current academic standards to make them proficient in terms of what we would now consider proficient by these state standards as measured by standardized tests. So that is, and it turns out to be a lot more complicated than you might think, but that is the basic question it set out to answer.
And what does it cost? What is that price tag, the average base cost?
Well, the price tag that this study came up with is $8,667 per year. That is what the authors of this report recommend that be provided as a baseline level of funding for each public school student in Michigan.
And as we know, just kind of from all the reports coming out about budgeting, some districts in Michigan are spending more and some are spending less. And you say the report finds there's room for concern about funding equity.
Yeah, so the sort of a sub-goal of this report was to take a look at the equity, overall equity of the Michigan school financing system. And it did find that there's some room for concern there. There is, in terms of the amount of money per pupil that each school district gets from the state, most school districts get somewhat lower than that roughly $8,600 figure that the report notes. They get between about $7,300 to $8,000. Now, some districts do get more, some significantly more, but most school districts get within that $7,300 to $8,000 range. But in terms of looking at the overall equity of the system, it said that overall Michigan school financing system is moderately inequitable, which suggests that it does an okay but not particularly great job of giving money to students with equal needs across different districts. What it doesn't do a great job of is providing greater resources to districts that have greater needs. And the report really does sort of hone in on that in terms of that it finds that students with greater needs are more challenging to educate and require more resources.
So we're talking low-income students or English language learners?
Yeah, the report specifically actually throws out sort of figures in terms of how much more they think it would cost to educate in terms of what it calls at-risk students, which you could think of as economically disadvantaged, and there are probably different ways of determining what that exactly amount to. The report says that those students should probably get roughly 30% more funding, and then in terms of English language learners, about 40% more.
But as I heard you tell me this morning on Michigan Radio, there's this negative relationship that exists for districts with higher need students. Talk about that.
Yes. Yeah, so apparently when you look at across districts there, when you see the districts with higher needs, they are not necessarily getting more resources, whether that's from the state in terms of the per pupil allotment or from local sources. Now, higher need districts do tend to get more federal resources, but when you look at the overall amounts of money that they're getting, there actually is apparently a slight negative relationship between greater need students that cost more money to educate, frankly, and the students who perform better.
Now, this report could be something really important, couldn't it, in framing what lies ahead for public education in Michigan? Or somebody could put it on a shelf and pretty much forget about it. And we know the legislature commissioned the study, but nothing in this is binding, is it?
No, it's not. And you're already starting to see sort of different reactions to it that break down along political lines. On the one hand, you see the education teachers unions and Democrats in the state legislature, more progressive groups, saying, we're not spending, you know, the price, it, this tells us a price tag of what we need, the minimum amount of money we need to be spending on students, and we're not meeting that, and we're clearly not even anywhere close to meeting it in terms of providing the resources that are needed for special needs students. On the other hand, one of the goals of the report was to sort of come up with this list of what it called exemplary districts that are relatively high performing, but do so sort of on the lower cost end of the spectrum. And representatives from the Mackinac Center, for example, and some Republicans in state legislature are saying, well, there are a certain subgroup of districts that seem to indicate that we can get higher performance standards, you know, while spending relatively less money. So that should sort of be the model we're looking at. And we're actually pretty close to where we should be. So you can already see things sort of breaking down along political lines in terms of the reaction to the findings here.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Sarah, thanks for filling us in. Great talking with you.
Sure. Thank you.
How far should a citizen go in trying to bust online predators? Zach Swears is a 23-year-old West Michigan man who goes online posing as an underage girl. He meets guys online, records everything as he sets up encounters, and then posts it all on YouTube.
There are too many predators on the internet right now. The supply of predators is too high. The demand to stop them, the resistance, is too low. It's only mathematical. You need a ton of resources to combat this, a ton of resources. You can't blame the police. It's overwhelming for everybody. There needs to be far more demand of resistance in order to combat the supply of predators and make the supply go down.
So far, Zach's efforts have led to the arrest of 7 men. One of those men is now suing him. And the Kent County Prosecutor's Office has warned Zach to stop his video vigilante ways. Chris Becker is the Chief Assistant Prosecutor for Kent County with us now. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you.
Why did the office send Zach that letter telling him to quit what he's doing?
Well, I think the biggest thing is the safety issue. Police do these types of things all the time, but they go with an overwhelming amount of force in support of whatever officer they're going with in terms of trying to apprehend or take into custody somebody like this, whereas he's going on his own, or in his latest one before we sent the letter, he went with, I believe it was his brother now, brother who was armed with a handgun. Well, you're just asking for a whole bunch of trouble, and there's a whole bunch of different ways that could go bad. On a variety of different levels, it's unsafe for him, unsafe for the public, unsafe for just about anybody that could be involved in that. It wasn't just a letter not to do that. We're not going to write any more warrants based on what he's doing because of that.
Because there have been some arrests, right? And one of the men pled guilty to attempted accosting, and he served a day in jail and paid a $1,200 fine?
I don't know the sentence. I mean, he pled to an attempt, and I think he may have got some probation as well. But yeah, there's been, we initially wrote, I think it was 7 cases on that. Even at the time that we wrote those, the Grand Rapids Police said, okay, thanks for doing this, but you know, we can't be doing this anymore given the circumstances and given the safety issues that we see. And he continued to try and do that and did the one where he brought his brother in with a handgun. And that's when we triggered our letter saying, you know, we're not going to be involved in this anymore because we're not trying to encourage vigilante justice.
Are you aware of anyone else doing this kind of thing, kind of freelancing stings on his own?
No. Never been here 21 years, never had anything like this come across.
And I'm just wondering, as you say, you did write out warrants 7 times. So what you're getting from Zach in evidence does kind of work from a legal standpoint?
Well, it wasn't like 7. They were kind of brought in all together. I mean, it wasn't like it was 7, you know, over a period of time. It was, you know, a lump was brought in, if you will, of seven of these things. And so, yeah, I mean, evidence is evidence, whether, you know, just because it comes from the police or the vast majority of evidence we present in court comes from outside sources, whether it be a videotape from McDonald's if there's an armed robbery, or, you know, maybe bank records. Those are brought from outside sources. So the fact that it's brought from an outside source, if it's all there, doesn't necessarily make it inadmissible in a court of law. So based on what we saw, what he brought in, there was a sufficient basis, and the Grand Rapids Police did some follow-up as well.
I know you can't talk specifically about the case, but as we mentioned, one of those 7 men is suing Zach for slander and invasion of privacy, and his attorney told the Detroit News, he says Zach is the real predator, finding lonely men online and engaging in pretty explicit conversation and then revealing she is under 16, air quotes around she. What are your thoughts from a legal standpoint about that argument that he's the predator?
I guess that's something for a civil court. I've been a prosecutor for 21 years, so I stay out of the civil arena, and that's something for a civil court and a civil attorney to deal with.
What are some of the challenges for a prosecutor when a citizen presents evidence from this kind of thing, this soft done? You say that it can, evidence is evidence?
Evidence is evidence. I mean, you know, challenges is, yeah, are we getting all of it? I mean, you know, if it has been edited or spliced or tampered with in some way, obviously that's going to be problematic getting it in. We probably can't get it in, but that's no different than a police video. I mean, a police video, they can have the same argument. So, oh, it was edited, it was spliced, you know, they didn't show the full thing. So just because it comes from a civilian doesn't change what we need to do to present it in a court of law.
Chris, we know there are people cheering what Zach is doing. They're saying, you know, good on you. Anything that shuts down a would-be sexual predator is a good thing. So what do you say to those supporters?
Well, police are doing this. I mean, it's not like the police are sitting on their hands and not doing anything. And that's the biggest thing I've seen in some of the comments. Well, if the police were doing their job, police are doing their job. The Internet Crimes Against Children, you know, Michigan State Police has. I mean, they're specialized in computer crimes, and they're doing stings like this as well as other investigations where they just, you know, they track, they get emails from the National Center saying, hey, we've got an IP address that's exchanging child pornography, and they'll do a search warrant based on an IP address. So the police are doing it. Unfortunately, there's you know, a tremendous amount out there,
yeah.
Whether it be vigilantes or police. I don't think there's, you know, enough people to stop it all. But they are engaged, and we're prosecuting these cases on a regular basis.
Are you worried others might follow in Zach's footsteps? I mean, is this getting talked about and noised about? And certainly people watched Chris Hansen doing
sure.
this kind of thing on NBC's Dateline for quite a while.
You know, I mean, Dateline, the Chris Hansen Dateline was a while ago, and this is the first time it's popped up. So I can't say I'm that concerned. There's been some blowback now. Now he's getting sued. You know, we've issued a letter. I guess I'm not that concerned that there's going to be all of a sudden a bunch of miniature Chris Harrisons out there trying to do the same thing. You know, it hasn't happened. It hasn't materialized yet.
Now, so far, based on what he's posted on YouTube, Zach Swears is saying, hey, I'm not going to stop. Could he wind up possibly facing charges if he continues doing this?
Who knows? You know, every case is different. Every fact's different. I mean, so I'm not going to say never, but it depends on what he engages in and what he does.
Chris Becker, Chief Assistant Prosecutor for Kent County. Chris, we want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
Zach Swears has recently taken down his YouTube videos of his interactions with alleged predators. Two lawsuits have been filed against him, the latest this past Monday. Stateside reached out to Zach Swears for comment, but he declined. It all started in 1969 with its creator selling it out of the trunk of his car. From that humble start in southeast Michigan, Cream magazine went on to become one of the top music publications in the world. Founder and publisher Barry Kramer helped craft a magazine unafraid to be irreverent, to be profane, and it helped build the careers of some of the biggest names in music in terms of artists and writers. Now a documentary film is in the works about Cream. It's called Boy Howdy, the story of Cream, America's only rock and roll magazine. Its producer is eminently qualified to tell the story. J.J. Kramer is the son of the late Cream founder, Barry Kramer. J.J., welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell us how this documentary came about, because I bet this is not the first time a filmmaker had approached you to do the story, is it?
You're absolutely right. I've been pitched on the idea a few times over the years, and in this time it felt a little bit different. I was connected with the director, Scott Crawford, through a mutual friend, Jan Uhelski, who is one of Cream's original founding editors. And Jan had a working relationship with Scott back in the, I want to say, the 80s or the 90s, as Scott had actually published his own music magazine called Harp, which employed a lot of former Cream writers. And so she vouched for him, spoke a little bit about his experience in the rock and roll industry and in the print industry, and then connected us, and we hit it off almost immediately.
What is the real story that you and Scott want to tell in this documentary?
What we really want to talk about is first how Cream initially came together. What we're going to be focusing on are those early years at Cream, from its 1969 launch to its subsequent rise as one of America's most popular music periodicals. It's really an amazing story if you think about it. It's this underdog story of this, you know, group of self-described misfits who came together in Detroit, which is by no means a media center. And within a few years, they were publishing arguably one of the most vital music magazines in the entire country, second only to Rolling Stone. They started in the Cass Corridor, then they moved out to a, you know, communal farm out in Walled Lake, and then back to Birmingham. They really stayed true to the area, never left Detroit.
What do you think your dad, Barry Kramer, wanted Cream to be and did not want it to be?
let's start with a second question. I think what he did not want it to be was another Rolling Stone. First and foremost, the writers at Cream did not consider themselves professional journalists. They were really fans first. Everyone is a rock critic, and I think that their voices were just louder than everyone else's. They really wanted this to be iconoclastic and irreverent and raw and unapologetic. A lot of the other magazines at the time were sometimes accused of pandering to record labels or to artists. That's definitively what they did not want Cream to be. No matter who you were, if you didn't put out a decent album, then you were going to hear about it. In fact, I've heard a lot of stories told to me over the years that there were actually business cards made up in those early years at Cream, and at the bottom it said, F you if you can't take a joke. And that was kind of their MO, you know?
Now, you're doing a Kickstarter campaign. You're going to be to raise money for this film, getting a trailer together. So where are you in the filmmaking process, JJ?
Really just at the infancy or in the infancy of the process. We've cut our Kickstarter trailer. We're just polishing it up right now. And if all goes according to plan, we're going to go live with the Kickstarter campaign early next week.
And when do you hope to have a film to show the world?
Winter 17 is what we're planning on. So obviously that can get moved up or pushed back depending on, you know, once we start to pull this thread in this massive, you know, Cream sweater, as I'll call it, and see how it unwinds and unfolds and all the different avenues that we're going to follow. It could lead to us, you know, pushing it a little bit further than the Winter 17 date, but that's what we're targeting.
Are you and Scott Crawford going to aim the film at those of us who were there? We bought Cream in the 60s and 70s and 80s before your dad passed. Or are you aiming it at those who weren't around and wondered just how cool this era was and what it was all about?
If we do it right, then it's going to appeal to both. I think that the story kind of transcends generations. So you have the nostalgic component from the folks who were there, and people are going to be telling stories, and people are going to be like, oh my gosh, I was at that concert, or I remember when that happened. There's going to be that component of it. But the story itself, this underdog story of people who came together and did something very special, sort of this lightning in a bottle type of situation, the right people, the right place, the right time, I don't think that's limited to a particular generation. I think that is a story that would appeal to, you know, folks of any age, and that's really my hope.
How can people follow progress? Have you got a Facebook page set up?
We've got a Facebook page, the Boy Howdy, the Story of Cream Magazine Facebook page. We also have a Instagram account. The handle is at Cream Magazine. And then we also have a creammagazinedoc.com website.
J.J. Kramer is the son of Cream Magazine founder Barry Kramer, producing a documentary film titled Boy Howdy, the story of Cream, America's only rock and roll magazine. Can't wait to see you, J.J. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's show was engineered by Bob Scon. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for being with us today and for listening.